Today's daf in Masechet Ketuvot, brought to you from Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh, is daf Chof. And let's once again get placed properly over here. We were talking about initially, yesterday, the main sugya had to do with Edim who said things about themselves subsequently. And then we had a question whether we can rely on the fact that we have a Pesha Asra, a Pesha Hiter, to be Mekayim the Shtar. If we had no other way to be Mekayim it, how far would they be allowed to go to make changes, essentially, in their Edus? Could they say that they were Pasul? Could they say that they were Ktanim? Could they say that they were Psulim because of Rishayim, that they were forced? Is there a difference between being forced Ayidei Momon or being forced Ayidei Nefashot? Can they add Tnaim? What would be if one of them would try to add and the other one wouldn't? These were all questions that we raised. Then we moved on at the end of yesterday's daf to discuss what the din would be if other Edim, who are Mekayim, the Ktav Yadam of these Edim, if they come along and they say different issues about the original Edut. And the last thing that we had is that if we needed these other Edim to say that this is Ktav Yadam, and together with their testimony that it is Ktav Yadam, they say something that actually cancels the Shtar. So they say, yes, they were, however, Psulei Edus. Or yes, this is their signature, but they were Ktanim at the time. Or yes, but there was a gun to their head. But what would be the din over there? So we said, obviously, with the Pesha Asar, we'll rely on what they say. We have no choice because they're the only source that we have that the testimony is kosher. However, if we have another source, such as other testimony and or another Ktav, which we're able to use to handwriting and now through handwriting analysis to confirm this Shtar is theirs, and then we authenticate it, so then we don't believe those witnesses. That was the last thing we said, which left us with a little bit of a shock. I mean, it's all very nice to say that we don't believe them, but the question was, can we actually use this shtar as a kosher shtar to collect, despite the fact that we have witnesses that are saying that it's not a kosher shtar? I mean, how would we do that? Wouldn't it be at least a hakasha? That is the issue that we're going to be talking about, continue to talk about today, because Rav Sheshes, he attempted to answer the problem by assuming that, yes, we will actually utilize the shtar to collect with, and the reason that we ignore the hakasha of the second pair of Edim is because of a technicality. The technicality being that since every hakasha is similar to a process of hazama, because on one level you are starting to cast doubt on the testimony of other witnesses, and just as in hakasha, we will not allow the case to proceed unless the defendant is present. Like in every case, and over here, these Edim are not present. So because of that technicality, basically, we don't pay any attention to the Hakasha. And that led to the question of how in the world can we utilize a shtar that is only kosher because of a technicality, and we have witnesses that are saying that it's not kosher, to take money from somebody based on that technicality. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. That was the last thing that we read, and let's reread it. On the third line, from the top on Daf Chof. Omalei Reb Nachman. So Nachman says to Reb Sheshes, look, it's all very nice to tell me that we have a technicality, but I mean, let me ask you something. You're saying because they're not present. You're actually going to make the shtar more kosher when they're not present than if they would be present? I mean, consider for a moment. Let's say that they were here and these witnesses come in and say, well, they were psuleiades or whatever, right? And then we ask them, so what's the story? I mean, it's possible that they would have said, yes, it's true, we were Ktanim. Yes, it's true, we had a gun to our head, whatever. I mean, I don't understand how, if you now understand that there's a doubt about it, it's going to be better if they're not here? Why is it better if they're not here? If they were here, and it would have been a real akasha, we wouldn't have paid any attention to utilizing the shtar, right? Because it's Umukheshes. So now that they're not here, Because, I mean, consider, if they would have been here, they might even have admitted it themselves, right? So Dilma Avamoda, so now, because they're not here, now all of a sudden they're believed. I think that's crazy. Elo Amar Rav Nachman, therefore, says Rav Nachman, of course it doesn't mean that it's a kosher shtar. That would be ridiculous. It can't be that we're going to collect with the shtar. What it means is that it's a kosher shtar in the sense that we're not going to rip it up. That's what it means. And the idea is that uke tre la ade tre. So we take these two witnesses. We have one set on one side against the shtar, one set with the shtar, but we leave the money in the chazaka of whoever it's in right now. When we say the money, by the way, there's another girsa that reads the property, because by the, as we'll see in the next case. So in the, here, it's fine to say mamona. The riot that Rav Nachman brings, it's referring to property, as we'll see. But the idea is the same. We cannot be motzi mamon based on something that is a hakasha. That's for sure. And therefore, says Rav Nachman, look, I'll show you that this is what we normally do. It's the famous case of Bar Shatya. Bar Shatya Zabin Nixon. Now, the reason he was called Bar Shatya is because he had a mental condition that would manifest itself at times. It was schizophrenia, in which he would have attacks of schizophrenia. And when he did, he had a din of a shote. He couldn't be responsible for his thoughts and what he decided to do. And he sold a piece of property. Now, the question was he actually having an episode of schizophrenia when he sold the property? So we two witnesses come and they claim, look, yeah, it's true. He did sell that property. However, we saw him and he was definitely not normal at the time. So it was kishu shoten. Therefore, it's an invalid sale. And then another two witnesses came and they say, no, he was actually perfectly normal and there's no reason to cancel the sale. So over there, Rav Ashi said, okay, so we have akasha of the witnesses, right? So what do we do? So we have two against two. So uke tre la hade tre, and leave the, now here's the question, leave the money or leave the property? So some of the girsaot say leave the property, and why it says that will become clear in a moment. Because when Rav Ashi says we have to go according to the chazaka and not be motzi something on the basis of a suffix, the question is, what constitutes a chazaka for Bar Shatya? You see? So in other words, if, let's say we're talking about a piece of property. This was a piece of property that he inherited. His father was a completely normal human being, and he owned that property for years. And now Bar Shatya is clearly the heir. There's no question about that. So then, yes, then we have a truly valid chazaka to Bar Shatya on this property. But let's say Bar Shatya has cash or Bar Shatya bought property, whatever. So now you're saying, well, we have a given that this is his. So why should we take it away from him? What do you mean we have a given? How do we have a given? We don't have any given, because you're not sure that he was saying when he bought this property, and you're not, it's the same question. You're saying, I never know whether this guy is sane or not at the time that the transaction takes place. And if that's the case, you have the same doubts about his ownership as you do about his sales. Don't tell me we have becheskas Bar Shatya. I mean, that's not the point. But in a case where Bar Shatya really had a chazaka on the field, then of course it means a true chazaka. We just need to make that clear. Let's say chazaka davata, and he himself bought it and sold it. So I'm reading kishushote zavan, kishushote zabin. I mean, I don't know what to do. He was crazy when he bought it, and he's crazy when he sold it. And we have the same subject both times. So why are we more certain that he really owned it than we do that he really sold it? So then we don't have that idea. But in any event, benogia our case, says Rav Nachman. Look, the bottom line is that we cannot utilize edus mukheshet to be motzi something from the chazaka of an individual, normal person that owns something. I have another question, by the way. I mean, it just sort of by the way, but didn't you say that the reason that it's considered to be a good contract, according to Rabbi Abo, is because, well, I mean, look, you can't put the witnesses in the defendant's seat if they're not present, and that actually is not clear. So let's look into that. That's true, okay? Rabbi Abo says this, outside of our discussion with Rav Sheshes and so on, you can never be mezim an aid unless it's in front of him, yes, but you can be makrish aidim that are not in front of him. So now this is Rav Nachman, basically, right? But the chiddush is that hazama shelo bifneihem nehid hazama lo havi hakasha miyahavi. And that is that every hazama essentially has two pieces to it. Number one, we're saying that you cannot trust their testimony. That's the same as a hakasha. I don't care why you can't trust their testimony. They were ketanim, they were psulim, they were anusim, they weren't even there. What do I care? That is a hakasha. Now, if I'm saying they weren't even there, I'm also taking advantage of the fact that the Torah allows me to attack them personally. That I can't do, because if they're not present, so then they won't listen to me. When they arrive, we'll look into it, right? Because, I mean, then if they weren't even there, they may end up being responsible monetarily, or in other cases, we may actually kill them because they were trying to talk about testimony in a capital case or whatever. That, of course, they need to be present. But that doesn't mean that we ignore the other component, which is that in every hazama, there's also, obviously, the implicit statement that these edim were not kosher for this testimony. So it shouldn't be any worse than if I said the rektanim. Therefore, says Rabbi Abo, you have to take that into consideration always. That doesn't change that kosher level. Now, getting back to the braita, okay, that we just had the argument about. So what did we say? We said, in yesh edim, shektav yadam huzeh, and we mentioned, just like sort of a throwaway comment, something that we never knew before. And that is that if you need to be mekayem their signatures through another example of their signatures, it would have to be from a shtar shekara alav arar v'uchzak bebeit din. It would have had to have been a shtar which was presented to court as being a forgery, and the person claimed it was a forgery, and the court went ahead and examined the shtar and discovered that it was not a forgery, and that they actually were mekayim the shtar, despite the fact that someone had tried to bring proof that it was a forgery. Then we know that the henpek that is on this shtar is 100% reliable. Now, this is the way Rashi understands it, at least according to the way most of the Mefarshim understand Rashi. And basically, it means that we are limiting handwriting analysis to cases where we are absolutely certain that all possible avenues for ziyuf were examined and were found to be not true. But if we don't know that, and it was just a standard henpeck, somebody brings in a contract, and the court is not nervous about this being ziyuf. They just want to go through the motions, so to speak. So somebody comes in and testify to the signatures, whatever, and they stamp it. There, that's not enough for us. Now that's how Rashi learns. And the truth is that there are those who actually paskin this way. And there is therefore a big limitation on the idea of using handwriting analysis, because it's difficult to find a shtar like that. Now, there's many shitas who disagree, including the Rush. And the Rush says that it doesn't mean that it has to be Karol of Arar. It's just bringing an example of where the Besdin would have to go through because normally the guy's made it that this is a shtar. So that's all that it's talking about. But it doesn't mean to add that only that kind of shtar do we rely on Besdin's handpick. Why would we doubt Besdin's henpeck? Okay, so that's a machlokas halacha lemaisa in how we would use handwriting analysis. Anyway, so the mashma'ut is over here that only if it was actually in court, right? Where the kara alav arar, but lo kara alav arar, lo. Again, depending on how it is that you understand that. Either it means there was a case against it, or it means that the court wanted to make certain that it was actually correct because the guy hadn't been made it to the event.
And that's what the Bach wanted to take it out? The Bach took it out because he's like the Rush? He took out that whole line.
Possibly. Misayele Rabasi. I mean, it may be, or it just may be Pasha. Misayele Rabasi, Dom Rabasi, Emekamim, Tashtar, Mishtashkalav, Har, Uzak, Bebeidin. Fine. I mean, what would be the point of, you know, I don't know whether it means more than that. It just seems to be pointless. Anyway, Armin Naradoi, there is another approach. And what is that? What if you don't have a shtar, shikara lava ara? There's an alternative. The alternative is to find their signatures on two shtarot, which are definitely good shtarot. How would that be? Well, for instance, let's say that there were sales. We have two separate sales, two separate properties. Somebody brings in these documents into court and says, listen, these signatures match those signatures. These signatures have provided a chazaka in each of these two cases. The person has owned this field now for 20 years. Nobody's ever claimed that anything was wrong with it, which means that these signatures are just used in normal business practice. And I know that these are the signatures of these two people. Now, if they match, so then that's good enough. I don't have to go through a henpeck. I can go through the very fact that this is the way that business was conducted. Or suppose there's two women, each of whom have a ketuvah, and according to the Ramah, have been married for years based on that ketuvah, and nobody's ever said anything about it. And it's these two guys, and I match it up, that's also good enough. So if you do that, you could be Mekayim Shtar for two ketuvahs, or from two sadot, but that's only as long as we know that they have been successful sales. Shofi means there was no attempt to go to court against the sale. So in other words, there was no micha'a from the ostensible seller that appears in the contract. Om Reb Shimi Barashi, all of this only applies when the other two shtarot are supplied to the Bezdin by independent sources. But suppose the guy himself who is attempting here to collect based on this shtar, he's the one that supplies these documents to the Bezdin. And he says, look, I know that this is their signature. Here you have examples of their signature for two friends of mine who sold property, and here's the signature. Then we don't believe him. Why? Because he could have forged them. In other words, if it's in his home and he obviously has access to the signature, so then you can use one document to forge another document if it's in your house and you've got time to do tracings and then to fill it in and so on. We can't trust that kind of thing. And therefore, if it's Yotze Mitachas Yado, then not. Why not? Dilma, I'm supposing you're saying that what? That Dilma is a euphemism, is Aife? That since it's Tachat Yado, so we're afraid that he forged it? So then even if somebody else has it, I mean, he could have seen it. I mean, well, what's the difference if it's in his house? What, we're able to ascertain that this guy never saw these papers at someone else's home? How do you know that? So Mitachat Yadei Achronami, maybe he forged it based on that. No. You can't forge something well enough if it isn't tachat yadcha, just by looking at something, and you're going to now remember it and reconstruct it accurately enough that it should be a real forgery that should be omed against handwriting analysis? Absolutely not. That we don't have to worry about. Now, by the way, here's another wonderful example of the difference between tviut ayin and simple professional analysis. If somebody comes along and says, I recognize this signature, we're never chayish for ziyufe, even in this case. The only thing that the Gemara is saying is that we will not base it on handwriting analysis. And why is that? It's because Tfiyas Ayin, remember, is better than any possible simen. In exactly the same way as the Gemara points out, if you know someone and somebody asks you to please call so-and-so from out of shul, you will walk straight in, go right over to the guy, and you will call him out. But if somebody describes to you based on 100 different points of description, you still will not be sure that that's the guy. So there's a tremendous difference between Tfiyas Ayin. Tfiyas Ayin is similar to artificial intelligence. We're over there, we've analyzed 1 billion different issues in all kinds of different ways, and now are able to make a match. That's much more than a simon. In which case, if someone recognizes the signature, we never say, well, the guy had another contract in his rishus, and therefore he could have forged it. You cannot forge a signature well enough to stand up to Tfiyas Ayin. This, by the way, is part of those beautiful stories in the blink analysis, you know, in which experts, they can't even tell.
Getty, from the greatest in the world, from the Getty, were fooled, and the expert on site.
Unbelievable. It doesn't matter how much of an expert you are, expertise doesn't help. There's something that goes beyond that, where your stomach starts hurting when you're in the presence of a forgery. That's something else. The same thing is true over here in terms of Tfiyas Ayin. Okay, Tana Rabban. Koteva dam eduto al hashtar umeid alei afilu liachar kama shanim. Now, this is fascinating. Suppose somebody was an eid, and he knows that he's got a poor memory, so he takes out his little spiral notebook, and he writes a note to himself, you know, on this date, I signed the contract, or I witnessed such and such an event. Okay, now it's 20 years later, and he's being asked to testify in Beis Din. So he looks at his little spiral notebook for that day. Oh, yeah, right. That was what I saw on that day. Can he do that? Or do we not accept extelligence for memory? That's a tremendous question, because the truth is that the Torah says, al pi shnei edim, right? Al pi means al pi hem velo mipi kitavam. So you cannot take testimony from written testimony. We'll talk about that in a moment. Because if that's the case, then you shouldn't be able to use a shtar at all, because a shtar is written testimony. Fine. Over here, we're talking about the guy who writes a note to himself. Comes along the braita to say, there's nothing wrong with using a note to yourself. Omer Avuna, that's only where he remembers it on his own, without the note, and he's just looking at the note to confirm and to jog his memory to get all the details straight. But he doesn't even remember. Somebody says, remember 20 years ago on such and such a date? No, I'm sorry, I really don't remember at all. Ah, come on, you got to remember. I don't remember. I'll look it up in your diary. The guy looks it up in his diary, and oh, yeah, he's right. I actually did. Can he go to Beis Din and testify based on that when he didn't even remember that it happened? No, says Rav Huna. Rabbi Yochanan says, yes, he can. As long as after he sees it, he then says, oh, yes, of course, that's true. And therefore, we're not really listening to him based on the Ktav. We've just gotten his memory back based on the Ktav. But what it is that he's testifying to is what he remembers, in which case even Rabbi Yochanan is made that he can't testify when he doesn't know what he's talking about. As he's testifying, he can't say, well, I made a note to myself on such and such a date. That's not called testimony. That would be mipi ktavo and not mipi atzmo, which is fascinating. Now, the question is, so then how do we have a shtar? A shtar is basically written testimony, right? So there should be no such thing as a shtar. Now the Rambam shita is, there's no such thing as a shtar. Meaning that the concept of a shtar is entirely a derabbanan innovation, and it's there in order to make business possible. Because obviously, if I can only rely on witnesses, and witnesses are here today, gone tomorrow, who the heck is going to do business if he's not going to be able to have any kind of proof to what he's doing? The Rabbanan, and having seen that, said that even though it's true, BPM Valomi Pitkavan, but we make a takana that when it comes to these issues, you're allowed to write testimony down. Wow, that is major. And not everybody agrees to that. Some understand that the Gemara over here, first of all, the din of Mipiem, Velomi Piktavam, think about what that means on a naive level. We have a guy who can't talk. He walks into Besdin, he's mute. He's not deaf. So the Baal Din says, listen, this guy had a stroke, but he was my aide and he can't speak, but he's happy to write out for you everything that happens. That's what the Torah is talking about. Aedus means he tells it to the court, not that he writes it to the court. But that has nothing to do with being able to send a deposition to the court, so that if Lamaisi, he can speak, but he's not in the place of the court, why can't he speak and have what he said written down and sent to the court? That's what it means, BPM Velomi Piktava. Some Rishonim learn like that, in which case the shtar would absolutely be perfectly okay, d'oraisa. The other approaches, there are many approaches as to what exactly this would mean. So there's one approach of Rashi, not here, but there's one approach of Rashi that the idea of Mipiem is that even if they write down the Edus, as long as they write it down at the time, and it's not that afterwards they reconstitute, because remember, that's the whole point of Edus, right? It's recreating. Okay, so if they recreate that Piktav at the time, that's not called Mipiktavan. Mipiktavan means a reconstituted testimony in Ktav. That's how Rashi understands it. Tosafos understands that it becomes a shtar when you have two Edim. That's not cool. When you have two Edim, that's a completely different thing. Plus, it becomes a shtar when it is written in legalese, so that it's meant for a bezdin, not just a letter in which somebody's sending his girlfriend the information of the murder that he witnessed. Well, I shouldn't really say nobody says that for a murder it's okay. It's all for sure only benogea this divrei mominus. So it's also has to be that the person who made the sale is the one that says to write up the contract to the witnesses. So then if you have those, then you have a contract. Okay. But in any event, what we're talking about over here is a note. And the question is whether memory based on a note is also considered to be memory, or whether it's considered to be a mipik tavan with the same chisorin as mipik tavan, since your memory relied on the ktav. That would be the issue. So the question, therefore, would be essentially, is intelligence included in intelligence? And by the way, there's an amazing element of this in the Torah, and that is your tefillin shalresh. Tefillin shalresh become part of your brain in terms of the halacha. And that is such an advanced idea that it's literally, the word was only coined in the past 20 years, which is that things that are written in the world and that are part of the general intelligence of the world are innately part of your brain, because you won't even be able to use language unless the meaning of those words is embedded in society as a whole. Right? So they coined this word extelligence. The fact that we consider karkafta with tefillin to be part of your skull is unbelievable. So that means that it's an extension of your brain. And the words that are written on the parchment in that tefillin, which is why they need to be organic, because they are actually part of your brain. That's why they have to be from Or Behema and so on and so forth. That's why it's the idea that it has to be peh. It has to be kosher to eat. It's part of the organism. And that's the incredible idea of the ritzuis that come down from both sides, which is the extension of the nervous system from the right brain and the left brain that are coming down and extending through the rest of your body. Because again, a new idea also, this one is 40 years old, which is that the brain is not just in the brain, which is also very profound insight, because your entire sensory system of all types of input is the idea of, I don't know who's the iPhone telling me extended intelligence. That's exactly what we're talking about. Who is this? I'll beat him up. What's going on around here? iPhones. There we go. Okay. Anyway, isn't that amazing? Come on. It's absolutely astounding. What is the Torah doing to us? So it takes, 3,000 years to figure out some basic, like, what could this be about? all of these little silly organisms running around, not having a clue to what they're doing. Anyway, fine. Okay. So this was the machlokas over here. So according to Rabbi Yochanan, as long as it jogs your memory. According to this, if you've got two witnesses, one of the witnesses doesn't remember, and the other guy comes along and says, hey, don't you remember we were in a pub at such and such a date? The guy came up, oh, yeah, I remember. So then that would be fine, because it's not considered to be mipiktavo, and over here it's not considered to be from the other guy, aid me be aid. Now, the question is, can the person, the Baldin himself, remind the witness? That's a question. What's the halacha over there? Are we worried that maybe there's going to be a little bit of pressure that's being put on the witness? And that therefore, in that case, we can't believe him when he says, oh, yes, I remember. And is that undue pressure? I mean, what do they call that? There's a word for that nowadays. Of pressuring the witness or interfering with the witness. I forgot what it's called.
Leading the witness.
Leading the witness. Leading the witness is more in court.
That's duress. I think they call it, say duress.
Anyway, what's the thing? Rav Chaviva says...
Tampering.
Huh?
Tampering.
Tampering. So Rav Chaviva Omar, even he himself, was Marvareh de Rav Ashi, says, no, we do not accept that if he himself was involved. And the halacha is, he himself cannot be involved unless, now this is fascinating, this is the way the Rambam learns it, unless he, that is to say the tamperer, is a Talmud Chacham. As Rashi learns, unless the witness is a Talmud Chacham, and then won't allow his brain to be tampered with because he'll be able to know the difference. But the Rambam learns, if the guy himself is a Talmud Chacham, then he knows what is duress and what is simple reminding him. It's actually a maisa. And that is, Rav Ashi was an aid to something that Rav Kahana needed to have in court. And Rav Kahana said to him, does Rebbe remember this maisa? No. You don't remember that we were standing together when we went to Italy? I don't remember. In the end, Rav Ashi did remember and came into court, and he was made for him. So he sees Rav Kahana is looking at him, and Rav Kahana doesn't want the court to accept the testimony. Now, wait a minute, says Rav Kahana. Oh, hold on a second, because he had just heard 2 days ago that actually Rav Ashi didn't remember this. So what, is he coming in to be made for my honor? What's going on over here? So Chazal Rav Kahana Davik Amachasen, he sees Rav Kahana being very, very reluctant about this. Omar Leh. So Rashi says, sort of kind of, what, you think that I would come to court because I'm being simich on you? Are you crazy? I know, the Ramoy Anafshoi Vidkari. I thought about it more and was able to, oh, yeah, of course. That happens, that your memory takes a while to come back in. Okay, now we have a very interesting, I mean, this is like, it sounds so incredibly tangential. And the reason that the Gemara is bringing it up is because it deals with elements of memory over time. And at the end of it, we're going to try to apply it to our din. So have a little bit of patience. Of course, this is all very familiar to all of you because of our favorite learning of Ayalais, of course. What else? So getting back to the Mishnayos and Ayalos, if you recall, the Mishnah says over there that where you have tluliot akrovot, bein la'ir, bein la'derach. So you've got these tluliot. So tluliot are little hills, more like a mound, that a long mound. Those kind of things very often will appear over time with rains, movements of the earth, changes in the area because of road building or whatever. Yes, you'll often find near a road or near a town these mounds. You can't remember how they happened. It could have been a building project or whatever it was. And you get these tluliot. Then the problem is that if they are close, now we need to define what close means. Bein la'ir, we need to define what city we're talking about. Bein la'derech, we have to define what type of derech we're talking about. So far, the mission doesn't mean anything. Echad chadashot, whether they're new, we have to define what new means. Echad yeshanot, or whether they're old. So everything, basically, we're just using words without giving any definitions. The halacha is over there that they are tameh. And they're tameh because we consider them to be places where people would have buried a mace, or, as we will see, places where maybe women would have buried miscarriages that are over the 40-day-old, therefore they can be metame and so on. So the rechokot, but those that are far away, which we have not defined, either from the ear or from the derech, which we have not defined, then the new ones, which we have not defined, are actually tahar, barrow downs. There we go, Ira. Yes, indeed. Exactly. So the chadashot taharot, the yeshanot are tmeot, and therefore, if you're being careful about tuma, which means you're being bridal from tuma, then a tam bam badil. And therefore, you would stay away from these barrows because you need to be bridal from the tuma. Now, let's start getting our definition straight. When we say near, what is near? We say if it's near, then even if it's new, it's going to be tameh. Near means within 50 amas. Okay. And if it's old, what does old mean? Where we say if it's old, it's tameh, even if it's far away. Old means 60 years old. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yehuda says, no. This is all relative. Near means it's the closest mound to the road. And old means that people don't remember when this mound showed up. Nobody can say, oh, I remember when I was a kid, there was no mound here. Anyway, and what is the meaning of a city? And what is the meaning of a path? Again, this is like a tremendous tangent, right? So, I mean, a city can't mean any city, and a road can't mean any road. You're telling me that any mound near any road, that's crazy. I mean, so what are we going to do? We're going to be machzik the entire Eretz Yisrael is tameh because there's a mound next to the road? That's absolutely absurd. Misfeka mimachzikin and tuma? Well, we're going to be machzik tuma in a place without having any indication that there was tuma there. Remember that Reish Lakish was talking about over there where we found bodies and we had already been mefaneh two of them, and the question was did I have a din of a shkunas kvarim, and they ended up saying being mater, taking out additional things, and Reish Lakish says it wasn't mikar adin, it was because in order to avoid tuma in Eretz Yisrael, they found some kind of heter, they found an excuse, and they wanted to make sure that there wouldn't be tiaru Eretz Yisrael. So you see that for sure we're not going to just create sveikas tuma out of nothing. That's insane. Therefore, let's actually define what we're talking about over here so that it begins to make sense. Ear. When we say an ear, we mean a city that is close to a Beit HaKvarot, and that they would be going from the city to the Beit HaKvarot directly. And a path means it's a road that is going to Beit HaKvarot from a city that does not have its own Beit HaKvarot. Fine. So then that's what we're talking about. And that's why we have an actual basis for considering tuma. Why? Well, I understand if you're on a road on the way to the Beit HaKvarot, because it might be Erev Shabbos, and everybody thought they were going to get the Kfura done before Shabbos, which was doubly important in those days when they had no way to be Shomer on the Mace if it's hot weather and so on. So they were desperate to get the Kfura done before Shabbos. They start the Levaya it's getting close to Shkia. And they say, oh my God, what are we going to do? We're not going to be able to make it before Shabbos. We're going to leave the mace in the middle of the road. That's a disaster. So they see the only choice that they have is to bury the mace in one of these mounds next to the road because they're not going to be able to get there in time. I understand that that can happen. But here, asmucha le Beit HaKvarot, I understand. What is the problem? If you have a city next to the Beit HaKvarot, you go to the Beit HaKvarot. Why would anybody bury a mace in a tlulit near a city? That's the reason why not to worry about it. No, you go directly to the Beit HaKvarot. Amar Rabbi Chanina, no, that's because Nashim Kovrot Sham Niflehem Umukeshchin Zro'otehem. So since it's true that if you had a real mace, so then of course it would go directly to the Beit HaKvarot and so on. But the problem is that if a woman had a miscarriage, doesn't want everybody to know about it. And if you have a Mukeshchin, this was the story about Yiftach. And because he could have one of the diseases like leprosy, so he could have a disease where you actually, different organs, different avarim turn gangrenous, you end up losing a leg, losing an arm, Rachman al-Itzlan. So then that's very embarrassing to people. And they would also, since that's metame, they would also be kover, and they wouldn't go directly to the Beit HaKvarot where everyone will see them like the rest of the town usually does. And they don't have any other way of being kover like they do in cities that are far from the Beit HaKvarot where they have a normal system of taking things to Beit HaKvarot privately because there is no local Beit HaKvarot. There you have to worry about it. By the way, this is a fascinating shaila and tshuva in contemporary psak. What is the halacha if someone, again, Rachmana Litzlan, but if someone had an amputation in a hospital, does he need to make sure that he gets the organ that was amputated from the hospital to bury because there's a chiyuv kvura on it or not? That's a big shaila here in understanding what it means when it says that the mukeshchin will bury. Is that a halacha that there's a chiyuv of kvura? Or is it simply a din that since it's metame, so in order to save kayanim from tumas meis, they would do such a thing, but it's not a chiyuv. So if the hospital is going to get rid of organs by incinerating them and so on, you would not have a chiyuv of recovering that organ and seeing to it that it was buried. This is an amazing shaila. Rav Meisha paskin that there's a chiyuv of kvura. And therefore, the chole has to be able to recover the organ from the hospital in order to be mekayim the mitzvah of kvura. But it's a big machlokas aposkim. Anyway, going on. Omer Rabbi Chanina, mitoch she'anashim kavrot she'niflehem mukeshchin zro'otehem. So that would be the problem. So therefore, why does it make a difference if it's 50 amos or more? Because at chamishim ama azla'i lechuda, a woman would go at night and bury up to 50 amas. She's not scared. More than that, she's going to take someone with her because she's scared. Once she's taking someone with her, so she'll go already all the way to the Beit HaKvarot. So dabra inish ba'ada, lo Beit HaKvarot azla. Hilkach, so this has nothing to do with being machzik tuma in Eretz Yisrael, chas v'sholem, tuma be'eretz Yisrael, lo machzikinam. Anyway, why are we bringing this up? Mishnah Ayala, so you're in Kisubis, can you tell me, please? I'll tell you. Shmami Nami Rabbi Meir. What did Rabbi Meir say over here? What is considered to be old? 60 years. Why 60 years? Because he says essentially that you can only trust memory up to 60 years. That's basically what he's saying. Otherwise, why in the world is he saying 60 years? He should just say, like Rabbi Yehuda, as long as somebody remembers. So you see from here that he considers memory to be reliable, achitin shnin, tve lo mitkar, which means that you can only trust the witness who is telling you something that happened up to 60 years ago. But if it's more than 60 years, then we don't consider the memory to be reliable. This has to do with our whole sugya, whether intelligence and externally written memory can be backed up. So can you back up your memory, Biksav? Okay, so apparently Rabbi Meir holds that your normal memory without any backup is only good for 60 years. But says the Gemara that Rav Chista is completely wrong about that. Hatam, hu de lo ramyale. In the case of the Tluliyot, He's not responsible for that memory. All it's saying over here is that people to reconstruct something, which is none of their darn business, it just happens to be something that happened around them. Their memory is reliable for up to 60 years. Beyond that, they have reconstructed their memories so many times that it no longer has any resemblance to the original event. And therefore, we don't call it memory, which is a very profound insight, because that's actually how memory works. And if, on the other hand, he was made responsible for this, which is an aid, somebody says to look, I need you to witness this and to be able to report back on it in court. Over there, it's not a casual remembering and then repositioning the memory in your mind where it makes absolutely no difference. The fact that you took responsibility on it is ipso facto a different type of memory. Therefore, it's irrelevant to our circuit. That's how Rashi understands it. The Chazon Ish does not understand Ramya Aleh as necessarily meaning it's his responsibility because somebody put it there. It means simply things that people are being asked about. Do you remember that there was a mound here? No, there was no mound there. I don't remember a mound. That's not trustworthy. Something that people do remember, it is trustworthy. There's a big difference between saying I don't remember between saying I do remember. So it's very simple. It's Rami Aleh, meaning he has actually paid attention to it. So therefore, what's the difference if it's a 100-year-old memory? He's telling you, this is what I remember. So then, afilu tuva nami, it would be perfectly okay. We have a word from a Kohen who is going to tell us in his neighborhood what the halach is of mounds that were 60 years old.
When I was Menachem Avil to Reb Medina many years ago, the Chevra Kadisha told him, he said over, the Chevra Kadisha told him that his father had lost the leg. And so they went to the kever to bury him and found the leg perfectly shalem after years, not decomposed at all.
Wow.
Maisa Shahaya.
I remember that, Maisa.
Right. The second, maybe I went with Rebbe. The second.
Yeah, I even think I remember that, but that's our sugya. Do I think or do I?
Right. The second thing is it was pouring rain. I was in Har Nof meeting with David Wilner and a cab came by with somebody in it. You know, they asked it. And then the guy in the front said, wait, are you Cohen? I said, yes, you can't come in. And they went on.
Wow.
He was carrying something. I said, you know, it's Eretz Yisrael.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. That's amazing. Mamish this, Maisa.
Gee, unbelievable. Unbelievable.